You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
From the heart of where innovation, money, and power collide, in Silicon Valley and beyond, this is Bloomberg Technology with Emily Chang.
I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco, and this is Bloomberg Technology. Coming up in the next hour, NATO talks tough, sending more troops to Europe's eastern border with Russia and warning Putin against the use of nuclear weapons. We will have the latest from President Biden's trip to Brussels, sanctions, and what it all means for Russian oil. Plus, a Bloomberg exclusive, Apple working on a hardware subscription for the iPhone and other hardware products. Why buy a device outright when you can just pay a monthly fee? We'll dial in our very own Mark Gurman. And Uber will now list New York City taxi cabs on its app. This is an effort to ease a driver shortage and higher fares and get a leg up on rival Lyft. We'll get to all of that in a moment. Continuing now, the war on Ukraine has now entered its second month. President Biden marking that grim milestone in Brussels, meeting with NATO leaders about what can be done to stop Russia's unprovoked aggression. The president was asked if Russia should remain in the G20, and this is what he had to say.
My answer is yes. It depends on the G20. That was raised today, and I raised the possibility if that can't be done, if Indonesia and others do not agree, then we should, in my view, ask to have both Ukraine be able to attend the meetings.
For more on the president's visit, we are joined now by our Bloomberg Washington correspondent, Anne-Marie Hordern, who is in Brussels. Anne-Marie, obviously a significant statement there from President Biden. So far, what has been the reaction to what he has had to say and his meeting with top European leaders?
Yeah, this was really a main headline coming out of that press conference the president gave at NATO following this extraordinary meeting. And it's been a slew of diplomacy here in Brussels, Emily. The president just wrapped up. He had a NATO meeting, a G7 meeting, and then he went over to the European Commission to address European leaders. When he says that he thinks that Russia should be vetoed and disinvited from the G20, he said that if not every G20 nation agrees, they would unanimous support. He thinks Ukraine, at the very least, should be invited to make sure they are there for part of these conversations. After this, Emily, the president will move on to Poland overnight. Tomorrow morning, he'll be traveling there, and he'll be meeting with his counterpart, as well as really seeing what is happening in terms of the human toll this crisis has taken. This is really going to be a little bit more of an emotional day. If today was really the diplomatic day, tomorrow is really an emotional day, a day about humanity, because this crisis has caused 10 million Ukrainians displaced either in their own home, or more than 3 million have actually fled to border countries, and Poland really being the ground zero for that.
Now, there is this question about just who President Biden is going to meet in the next 24 hours. He was, a little circumspect about what was coming next. What do we know about who exactly he's going to meet and what the impact of those meetings will be?
Yeah, some details at the moment are not released to the press, obviously for some security concerns, but the president in the morning, he'll still be in Brussels and he'll sit down with Ursula von der Leyen. And we also are expecting from the United States, and the president signaled this evening, is some more details about potentially what the U.S. can do in terms of shoring up natural gas supplies for Europe, because we know how dependent Europe is on Russian natural gas and oil. And at this moment, that is really the continuous lifeblood of the Russian economy that has pretty much been saved in terms of these harsh penalties and sanctions. Then when the president goes on to Poland, we do know over the weekend he'll be sitting down for a bilateral with his Polish counterpart, President Duda. There's going to be a number of issues to discuss, but most top of priority will really be the humanitarian focus, given the fact that Poland is really dealing with an influx of refugees and asylum seekers from Ukraine.
Anne-Marie, of course, traveling with the president, but we're going to be following the president's every move. Meantime, new exclusive deals on the breach of Okta and the group behind it. Bloomberg has learned that a 16-year-old from England is believed to be the mastermind behind the attack. Bloomberg's William Turton was behind that scoop. He joins us now. So, William, just who is this 16-year-old teenager who lives with his mom, and how did he pull this off?
Well, you know, we're not naming him, obviously, because he's a minor, but he's a very talented hacker. One person I spoke to who was responding to him hacking a company said that he was so fast and so proficient that at first, when they were observing the activity, they thought it might be automated, like it was a script. But no, it was just this 16-year-old kid who actually kind of has, like, a pretty expansive online presence of him dabbling in hacking. And, you know, now he's probably one of the most notorious cyber criminals of all time. You know, he's achieved that label really quickly because this group has hacked into Microsoft, Okta, NVIDIA, you know, these huge targets that spend millions and millions of dollars on cybersecurity. I mean, I haven't seen anything, a cybercrime group like this in many years.
So now that we know who he is, what could the consequences for this kind of attack be?
You know, it's really interesting. The laws in the UK, especially with minors and these sorts of crimes, are pretty different. And there's been actually kind of historically a problem of when you have minors who are hacking, kind of keeping them off the computer. This is really reminiscent of the hack of Twitter that happened last year, where it was a lot of minors involved in pulling off the hack. Now, it's different because many of them were in the US and, you know, they were very quickly arrested. But it's difficult, really, to keep these kids away.
And what do we know about the actual consequences to Okta and the businesses that have been affected? Of course, Okta has been very clear. Okta itself was not breached, but there are these 366 other businesses that were compromised.
Right. Yeah, in part of our story yesterday, you might have noticed, we reported that the hackers used their breach of Okta in order to enable further hacks. Now, we don't know what the details are, but if you're a company like that, Okta, that's basically the worst case scenario. And so, you know, I don't think we know exactly what happened. We know what the company has said so far, that there were a limited number of accounts accessed. But still, when you're a company that offers a service that does identity management, it's the last thing that you want to happen.
All right, Bloomberg's William Turton, will continue to watch your reporting on this. Thank you for bringing us that story. Meantime, it is the first alliance of its kind in the United States. Uber will list New York City yellow taxis on its app to help combat a driver shortage and rising fares. Yep, you heard that right. More on that next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice, or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Uber will list New York's yellow cabs on its app. This is the first alliance of its kind in the United States. The announcement sending Uber shares jumping Thursday. I want to get more on this with Bloomberg's Jackie Davalos, who covers Uber for us. And this, Jackie, after years of acrimony, nobody thought this would ever happen. Why now?
You know, no one could have seen this coming. It's been a contentious decade ever since Uber stepped onto the scene in New York. And really what this means is it's an acknowledgement by Uber that they can't do this alone. They have said that they want to get every taxi in the world on their app by 2025, and it's a really ambitious goal. So to be able to pull it off in New York is a true sign that they are going to tackle this in the U.S. head on, and it's a good sign that they might get a competitive edge over Lyft. So a few things at play, but more so, you have to think about the driver shortage. They needed a boost to supply, and this is certainly going to give them that.
What does this mean for drivers? Uber is billing it as a win for them. Is it really? And what does it mean for fares, given gas prices and inflation more broadly?
Well, for sure, the boost in supply, it's about 14,000 taxis in New York that are now going to be available on the Uber app. Customers can hail a ride just like they normally do, but now it could be a cab waiting to pick them up. And so for the cab driver, they're going to be paid in the same way that other app-based drivers in New York are paid. They have a minimum wage that's set by the city, and this differs from the metered fares that they are typically used to. Now, Uber says that this rate that they're paid by the city is actually better on average than the metered rate. So this could be a boost in earnings for New York City's cab drivers, but also, you know, just more business. They saw their demand for cabs decimated when ride hailing came into town. And so I think from one perspective, it's not just going to put more people in their cars, but also maybe more money in their pockets.
All right. How times have changed. Bloomberg's Jackie Davalos. We'll see how this works out. We're going to continue this conversation with the CEO of Uber himself. You can tune into Bloomberg Technology Tuesday for our exclusive interview with Dara Khosrowshahi. I'm catching up with him at Shop Talk, one of the biggest retail conferences in the world in Las Vegas. Meantime, shares of EV maker Rivian rose to the highest level in 3 weeks. The company has been in the spotlight since its glitzy November IPO, but the stock has tumbled ever since. And Rivian's value has fallen from $150 billion to just $42 billion. Bloomberg News spoke with the company's CFO, Claire McDonough, who says if the company can ramp up production and build capacity, the share price will, quote, take care of itself. With the war in Ukraine still raging and inflation here in the U.S., companies and investors alike contending with volatile markets. How long will it last? And what is the path forward? Let's talk about it all with Kathy Gao, partner at Sapphire Ventures. Kathy, what are you telling your companies about how long to plan for this kind of market volatility and how to navigate it?
Hi, Emily. It's so great to be here, first of all, as always. What confusing times we live in, right? Everyone is trying to make sense of it all. And I'm super happy to be here today to share my perspective as a venture investor. Now, I think the word everyone is using today, including myself, to describe the current approach to the market is uncertain. About half of the NASDAQ had valuations slashed by 50% in a matter of weeks. And uncertainty is really the foe of the markets. This turbulence is creating a very, very confusing fundraising environment for tech entrepreneurs and for investors. Frankly, no one knows what's going to happen, right? But because no one has the magic ball, there are certain ways that founders can prepare themselves, even though we don't know when the other shoe, so to speak, will drop or how far it is to drop.
How is this impacting valuations? It certainly seems like things have taken a pause, if not some companies maybe having to take a haircut if you're trying to raise money right now.
Well, you know what? Private markets for software companies, and I focus on software companies, so other markets might be seeing different things, have not yet meaningfully corrected. I am hearing some anecdotal stories about lower valuations and some retrades in later stage deals, but there's not been a lot of discernible pattern yet. Frankly, the early stage also seems to be quite insulated at this point in time. And I think it's important to also call out that there is a lag between public market movements and the private markets. And we haven't felt the full impact yet in the private markets. Now, this lag has been seen in prior cycles as well, in the dot-com crash, during the Great Recession. This time, there's also just a massive amount of dry powder on the sidelines. I think over $100 billion was raised last year by U.S. venture capital firms alone.
So given the amount of dry powder, do you think that we won't necessarily see as dramatic an impact on private markets that we would had all that money not been raised?
It's definitely a counter force to what's happening in the market. But, you know, my prediction is that we will see an impact in the private markets, first with the late stage, which we're kind of seeing already. But usually these things take a quarter, 2 quarters, maybe 3 quarters to see, and it will hit the late stage companies first, flow into the mid sector, and then hit the earliest stage companies last.
So what do you see is coming next? If you could sort of map out the second half of the year, what are you planning for?
At the end of the day, what we do at Sapphire is striving to back the most exceptional entrepreneurs and companies of consequence. And regardless of what's happening in the markets, following that North Star of investing in absolutely the best teams and companies, I feel will cut through the volatility in the longer term. Now, what I'm telling my CEOs are there are certain things you can do to protect your business in case the fundraising markets tighten up for the rest of the year. These are things like making sure that you have enough cash on your balance sheet, right? Taking care of your current customers. It costs way more to acquire a new customer than to retain an existing customer. And also, don't forget about retaining your employees as well.
Kathy Gao, Sapphire Ventures, thank you for sharing your perspective with us.
Thank you
now
so much.
To that big Apple news, hearing it here first, Bloomberg has learned the iPhone maker is working on a subscription service for the iPhone and other hardware products, a move that could make device ownership similar to paying a monthly app fee. This according to people with knowledge of the matter. I want to bring in Bloomberg's Mark Gurman, who broke this story. Mark, how exactly would this work?
Yeah, thank you for having me. This would be no different, like you said, than your monthly $10 Apple Music subscription or $15 a month Apple One Bundle subscription, right? You'd be paying for the phone on a monthly basis like you might on a car lease. Now, this is different than installment programs and carrier subsidy programs today. What Apple and the carriers allow you to do if you don't want to buy the phone outright is split up the cost, whether that's $1,200, $1,400 or less for an SE and such, over 12, 18, 24, 30 months, depending on your carrier. This would be a set fee that's not the cost of the phone divided by, you know, how many months there are in a year or 2 years.
So, and would this apply to not just the iPhone, but iPads, laptops, Apple Watches? How far does this go?
It'll start with the iPhone. Eventually, it's possible that Apple will also expand it to other hardware as well. Part of the program is the ability to upgrade to the new model annually as they come out. Just like if you have an Apple TV Plus subscription or an Apple Music subscription, you're constantly getting new features and content as part of that monthly fee you pay. And so there's other devices that are also on an annual cadence, like the Apple Watch, like the iPad and the Mac in some respects as well. So I do see this expanding over time. And I also believe one day this could become the preferred method of buying Apple products instead of having to pay, you know, those prices at the beginning of the purchase.
So what does that mean for Apple in terms of revenue? I mean, do you see this bringing in, you know, significantly more revenue if people aren't buying the phones outright, but more people spring for that option because they don't have to?
Well, this is going to be just one option, right? There's still a lot of people who are going to use the installment plans and installment programs from both Apple and the carriers. There's a lot of people who are still going to buy the phone outright. This is going to be another option at checkout when you go to the Apple online store to tie the subscription price to your Apple ID. I think this is going to ultimately increase revenue for Apple because instead of just getting a $1,000 payment once from a consumer, they might get $20, $30, $40 per month for several years, right? And they're going to be able to sell those phones over many years to consumers and add up to maybe some consumers paying $300 or $400 a month for a group of Apple products and services. So I do think this is going to be a positive for Apple, and it's going to mean more upgrades, more services purchases, more app downloads. So I think overall, this is a smart transition that you're going to see happening, and they're not the only one doing this, right? Google has a program called Pixel Pass, right, which is a subscription program for a combination of their device and their services. Obviously, their device is nowhere near as popular as the iPhone, but they're trying it. Peloton as well. Peloton is testing a $60 to $100 monthly fee for leasing their bikes. Obviously, Peloton is not doing as well as Apple, but again, these are examples of other companies moving in the same direction.
When is this transition happening? When can people do this?
So they have been working on this for a little while now. It was originally scheduled to launch sometime this year, the end of this year. So probably between the end of this year and sometime next year.
And how quickly do you expect Apple to ramp something like this up, move from, say, an iPhone to other hardware products?
You know, over time, right, I think it'll start out if it works well with the iPhone. If they continue to generate more revenue on the iPhone than they were without this program, then you probably would see this, you know, rapidly expanding. I think it will be iPhone-focused, iPhone-first, given there are so many installment and carrier plans, even Apple's own iPhone upgrade program, Apple's Apple Card monthly installments program with Goldman Sachs for the phone. So I think they're just continuing to add different purchasing options for the iPhone to make it appealing to more and more people. So I think it'll be iPhone-focused for at least a little while.
Bloomberg's Mark Gurman, great scoop, Mark. Thank you for bringing that to us. Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco. We're still assessing the fallout of employees pushing back and walking out on Disney after CEO Bob Chapek initially refused to take a position on a controversial Florida bill, then changed course. One of my next guests says Bob Chapek needs to go, calling him the worst Disney leader he can remember, adding that the company needs to bring back former CEO Bob Iger. Joining me now, the man who said that, Ross Gerber, president and CEO of Gerber Kawasaki and a Disney investor. I'm also joined by Ivan Feinseth, chief investment officer of Tigress Financial, who has a buy rating and 12-month price target of $229 a share on Disney, which is the highest of all analysts tracked by Bloomberg. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. Ross, I want to start with you. Why are you so disappointed in Bob Chapek so far?
Well, first, it started with Scarlett Johansson. You know, when he first took over and the way he was handling talent was just horribly done to ultimately end up giving her the same amount of money anyways. And when you start ruffling feathers with the most talented people in your, you know, movie business, that doesn't make sense. And then now we've moved on to political issues where Disney has always had a long history of liberalism and sort of educating our society about liberalism through movies and shows and animation. For so long, we expose our children to new ideas through Disney. So I found it incredibly poor leadership that an issue as simple as the one in Florida was one that, you know, Chapek waffled on. And it's something that's crucially important in our society today, that we have more acceptance of all people, and Disney stands for that. So the fact that this was a difficult issue for Chapek to deal with really just makes me doubt his ability as a leader. He should just be an operations person. And that's what I miss about Bob Iger. He was such a class act. He was such a gentleman and mensch, and just always made Disney look good no matter how difficult the situation is. And I'm biased because I'm a big fan of Bob Iger and I miss him. But, you know, I'd love to see him back.
Ivan, what's your reaction to that, given that you're clearly bullish? You've got such a high price target here and you must, I believe Bob Chapek is doing a good job.
I do. First of all, he became CEO and right as we were going into the pandemic lockdown, where travel was shut down, movie studios were production was shut down, theaters were shut down, cruise lines were shut down, and the parks were shut down. And he did a great job stewarding the company, saving cash, cutting expenses, and investing in the expansion and increased content for Disney Plus and their direct-to-consumer streaming services. So he has gone through a really difficult time. I agree with Ross that Bob Iger was a great CEO, but I don't agree that in this unfortunate time that Bob Chapek, I think he did a great job. And he said in his note to employees, if he took a hard stance either on either side of this position, that it would be used as a political weapon. And I agree. And Disney is a company that leads in a lot of areas, especially in acceptance, but they are not a political company and they do sidestep controversy whenever possible. So I don't really think he acted as best he could in somebody in the situation that he's in. But the bigger picture, as far as investors, he has so far done a great job as the CEO in a very tough time. And I think he will continue to do so as the parks, you know, open and travel opens. You already see that to the extent parks have been open. They've had record levels of attendance capacity, record ticket prices, record in-park spending. So the company's doing well. And he has grown Disney's direct-to-consumer streaming services very well.
Ivan, is taking a stand on this bill, though, really a political issue? I mean, Disney has been about inclusion since, you know, as far back as I can remember. I mean, it's a small world after all. Would taking a position on this bill from the beginning really have been that political at all?
Yes, because it would have been whatever stance he took would have been used against him.
Ivan, what's wrong with taking a stance against discrimination and having people who are for discrimination be against you? See, this is where I see leadership. Let me finish. Running a park is one thing, and leadership is another. I agree 100%. If you put him in a room by himself, he's done a great job operating parks or Disney Plus. But a CEO's job is to be in the public and to represent the values of the business, not just operate the business. That's a CEO's job. And that's where he was and that's where he should be. But when you're talking about leadership and being scared to take a position on such a simple thing, it is wrong to discriminate against gay people, especially children, in school, and to make a law to do that and have any confusion over this because you don't want right wingers attacking you. Like, this is the problem. People care about the moral values of the CEO as much as it identifies with that company. And now you got people on strike and you got nobody's happy with what he's done.
So Ross, here's a question. Look, Bob Chapek got a lot of pushback. And then he changed course. He did a 180.
That's even worse.
He's doing this listening tour. Isn't that leadership when you can admit that you made a mistake?
Yes, and no. Not if the mistake is stupid.
Well,
all right, Ivan, your thought.
I don't believe his stance was stupid, and I do like people who can change their opinion based on information. So the fact that people change their opinion on things, I don't think is negative. I think it's a positive. Disney has been a supporter of the LGBTQ community for years. They were one of the first companies to extend benefits to same-sex partners over 25 years ago. And they are a extremely inclusive company. That's that produces great. Extremely inclusive and enlightening content. And I think it's not a simple stance. And it happens to be, I mean, they have a tremendous presence in Florida, but Florida has been a very, very politically charged state. And unfortunately, I think his first reaction of not to take an extreme stance because it would have been used against him, and it is being used against him now, no matter what position. And if he takes a more progressive position toward it, he's also being criticized. So you can't criticize him on both sides. But my job as a research analyst is to focus on investment opportunities. And as an investment opportunity, I think Disney's brand equity, its industry leadership, the quality of its content, the direct-to-consumer streaming service, and the fact that they get really a tremendous bang for their investment in content dollar, because not only is it on streaming, it's in theaters, it's on Broadway, it's in licensing, it's in driving people to the theme parks, to their cruise right. ships. So they really create a lot of value with their content. And they are, and as I say, in media, content is king, and Disney is the king of content.
So here's another question, Ross. Bob Iger has said he's gone. Any thought that he might come back to this company is quote unquote ridiculous. So if Bob Iger's not coming back, who is the right person to lead the company if not Bob Chapek? Or maybe we give Bob Chapek some more time.
So Howard Schultz just came back. So, you know, you never want to say never, because I never would have suspected Howard Schultz would be back at Starbucks, which I think will be beneficial for Starbucks. I don't know. Iger's a very young person for his age, so he certainly has the physical ability to do this, and I think he has moved on from Disney. But I think the correct pick for CEO of Disney should have been Kevin Mayer. It should still be Kevin Mayer. Kevin Mayer has gone on to do a wonderful job working in many different businesses now. I've met Kevin, and I think he's one of the sharpest people in Hollywood. He's super connected, and he has the type of personality that could have handled this a lot better than Bob. Now, not to say that anything Ivan's saying is incorrect from an investment thesis. I actually own the stock personally and for my firm. Not Ivan actually doesn't. And I'm an activist shareholder. And so what that means is, as the owner of the business, I don't like what my CEO is doing. And so I'm talking about that. That's what I'm saying. I would like to have the CEO of Disney really represent the values of Disney. Now, the fact that he's going on a listening tour is called placating people. I don't think his views are any different. He's just got to placate people. And that's my problem with all this. Oh, he's listening and all this. Well, come on.
All right, Ivan, I'm going to let you have the last word here because obviously Rosh pushed back on a few things there.
Yes, he's right about Howard Schultz, and I think that was good to see at Starbucks. But I think this is a different situation. However, we do own Disney on behalf of clients in accounts that we manage. Our firm policy is that analysts and portfolio managers cannot have personal positions in it. But I do have a buy on the stock, and we do own it on behalf of clients, and it's on our focus opportunity research list and portfolio.
Yeah, because the disclosure said your firm didn't own the stock. Sorry.
Oh, we do. I thought it was on there that we did. But I think that Chapek, it'll be a learning experience for him and the company. And I think the bigger picture is a company has responsibility to a lot of stakeholders, not only shareholders, but employees, vendors, customers, people who visit to the park. And, you know, they have a broad base of clients or customers that view their content, go to the movies, go on their cruise ships, go to the theme park too. So he has a big audience, a big group of stakeholders that he really has to care for. And I think that overall, he's done and will do a good job.
Well, certainly Disney has a lot of opportunities and challenges ahead. And of course, Chapek himself. I appreciate both of you joining us and coming to play. Ross Gerber, Ivan Feinseth, will continue this debate. Coming up, Bitcoin rallying, but will it last? As the war on Ukraine rages, so does volatility in crypto markets. We'll talk about all that and more with Spencer Bogart from Blockchain Capital. That is next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice, or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Time now for our crypto report, with Bitcoin climbing to more than 44,000 for the first time in almost a month, breaking out of its recent narrow trading range. This increase closely mirroring gains among U.S. equity indexes, but the cryptocurrency was also boosted by speculation that Russia is mulling accepting it for payments, and that the operator of the Terra blockchain is buying the digital token as a reserve. Let's talk about all that and more with my next guest, Spencer Bogart from Blockchain Capital. Spencer, what do you think was driving the jump today?
Sure. I certainly think that all of those headlines are having an impact here. I think there's just broadly also a question of what type of hard assets do people want to own in an inflationary environment? And I think that that backdrop is also driving additional demand for Bitcoin and other hard assets.
And yet Bitcoin has been trading in a fairly narrow range over the last few weeks, despite being such a big part of the news and you know, these global headlines that we're seeing. Why do you think that is?
I think it's part of a longer-term trajectory of Bitcoin just seeing reduced volatility over time as its market cap and trading volume and market infrastructure matures. I think that recently there's been, you know, some debate about what the current market backdrop of, you know, secular growth, increased demand for hard assets means, coupled with a world of rising interest rates where the price of money or the cost of capital is increasing and maybe pulling out from some of the more volatile segments of the market.
So looking at short-term moves, what about the long-term? What happens to Bitcoin? What is Bitcoin? What does the market look like 5 years out? We talked to Mike Novogratz about that, Galaxy Digital. Take a quick listen to what he has to say.
The whole year I thought we'd be a 30,000, 50,000 range in Bitcoin, risk to the upside, not the downside. But I think, you know, 5 years out, if Bitcoin's not at 500,000, I'm wrong on the adoption cycle, right? We see an adoption cycle that accelerates. Bitcoin grew so much faster last year, crypto grew, than the internet did in its best years in the 90s.
Spencer, is it at $500,000 in 5 years?
500,000 exactly, I'm not really sure. And look, Novo and I might disagree on many different points, but I agree with him here. I think that people overthink Bitcoin and crypto as a whole quite often. I mean, realistically, I think the easiest thing to do here to do well is to have a long-term time horizon. You know, what's going to happen in any particular day, week, month, or even year is extraordinarily uncertain. And a lot of people, I think, prefer to do themselves brain damage trying to anticipate those market moves, when I think the easier solution here is to have a small percentage of your portfolio and orient towards the long term. And that could be just Bitcoin, or it could be a basket of crypto assets.
What's your take on President Biden's executive order and the role that crypto is playing in the war on Ukraine? Do you think we are looking at a turning point in history for this cryptocurrency and cryptocurrency in general?
Potentially. I certainly think that crypto is a component of this discussion, right? I think that what's been made very clear, not just with the war in Ukraine, but I think across global events over the past couple of years, is really become evident that money and financial services have become weaponized. And sometimes that weaponization is used for things that would probably have broad support. And other times there's opposition. But regardless, there is demand for a neutral, apolitical money and infrastructure, and that's what Bitcoin and public blockchains represent.
But there's also a concern that cryptocurrency and digital assets could be weaponized. For example, that Russian oligarchs could use it to circumvent sanctions. Does that concern you?
It does not concern me. Most of the U.S. governments and foreign experts on these agree that there is no material portion of money laundering or sanctions evasion that occurs via crypto. So I don't think it's a material issue. And clearly the vast majority still occurs in hard assets like gold or in paper U.S. dollars.
All right, Spencer Bogart, always good to have you here. Thank you for giving us a long-term view. Blockchain Capital. Getting back to travel. More and more people looking to get away, and who better to talk about that and more than the CFO of Away herself, Catherine Dunleavy, who joins us now. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us. So obviously, there's a lot of conflicting things happening in the world right now. In some places, it seems like the pandemic is nearing an end. In China, for example, we're seeing a spike in infections. In the United States, you're seeing businesses reopen and this effort to try to live with the virus, no matter how badly it comes back. How is this all impacting travel in the months and year ahead?
Well, travel is seeing a really terrific recovery. You can see it in TSA throughput numbers that are almost back to pre-pandemic levels. Amtrak, 4 million more passengers have booked this year than last year. And even road trips, 26% more road trips are being taken these days. So people are just wanting to get out. And I think it's important to note, Emily, that the definition of travel has really changed post-pandemic. Travel can still be a trip across the country or across the world, perhaps, but it can just as easily be a trip or a hike to upstate New York, for example, a walk around the block, or even just going to the gym. People are getting out of their house, and we, in a way, are making the products that are inspiring all those journeys.
Is what's happening in China a concern to you, though? I mean, obviously, it's a massive country. You know, there's a strict, there more restrictive lockdown measures. You know, what are you taking away from that?
Well, I think that, again, people view travel as a critical part of their self-care routine. And so they're going to find a way to travel. It will just be different. They're going to find the ways to travel that are safe for them. So no, it's not concerning me.
How has this all impacted Away's business? I know you've launched some new products over the last couple of years, but you know, obviously you still need a suitcase whether you're going to driving to a national park or flying across the country.
Right. So Away, we have a lot of momentum. Every quarter and month of last year, 2021, we saw an increase in demand. In fact, in the fourth quarter of 2021, demand exceeded pre-pandemic levels. And we just closed the books in February, and I'm happy to tell you that our revenue was up over 20% compared to pre-pandemic levels.
How is Away adapting to the pandemic, or what have you learned from the last 2 years about maybe how to be more nimble in the next 2 years?
Well, you know, we just kept going during the pandemic. As you mentioned, we launched new products, a pet carrier. We launched a new store in Seattle. And we took the time to write a long-range plan that positions us for future growth no matter what happens. And so we have put in place great supply chain strategies that allow us to build inventory and have it close to the consumer so that no matter what happens, we will be able to meet consumer demand. And that's exactly why our results are so strong.
And what about the rise in inflation and gas prices and how that's going to hit consumer pocketbooks? Is travel going to be the first thing to go or no, because people haven't been able to do it for so long?
Yeah, it's a good question. And we've spent a lot of time talking to our consumers about that. And what they're telling us is that, again, it's a part of their self-care routine and it has moved up in their share of wallet. And 45% of people expect to spend more, even with the current economic and unknown conditions. 45% are spending more than they did before the pandemic on travel.
All right. Well, certainly going to be an interesting set of months and year ahead. Catherine Dunleavy, CFO of Away, thanks so much for joining us to share your view on what's to come. And that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. You can join us tomorrow. We'll be joined by Aya Kantorovich, head of institutional coverage at Falcon X, to talk about all things crypto and much more. And don't forget to check out our new podcast. You'll find it on the terminal, of course, and online. You can find it at Apple, Spotify, iHeart, and basically wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Emily Chang. This is Bloomberg.